I'd like to welcome you a great afternoon, and welcome to Expert Second Opinion. Investigators provide perspectives on the best practice use of immunotherapy for endometrial cancer. I'm Ruthie Solani, and I'll be moderating the meeting today. I am thrilled to be joined by some wonderful faculty. First, we have Dr. Flora Backus, who's a good friend and colleague from The Ohio State University, and Matthew Powell from WashU, who is also our SGO president-elect. Here we have our relevant faculty conflicts of interest, so please review these. We also like to acknowledge... Sorry, I didn't go through those. We also have some video guests who will also, it's an all-star lineup for you today. So here are also their disclosures, Dr. Secord, Dr. Matulonis, and Dr. Letterman. I'd like to thank Research to Practice. We have some, they are a commercial support for today. The CME Planning Committee staff and reviewers have no conflict of interest to disclose. This program will contain discussion of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. We always remind you to refer to the official prescribing information for each product for its approved indications. So here's our title, and like I said, we have a really all-star lineup for you. In order to make this meeting more relevant to participants, Dr. Love also conducted video interviews with Professor Jonathan Letterman, Dr. Ursula Matulonis, and Dr. Angela Secord, during which they will be present cases throughout from their practice. Excerpts from these interviews will be shown throughout the program, and our faculty will provide a second opinion. So this is where we're headed today. Dr. Backus will begin with the biology and biomarker assessment of newly diagnosed disease. Dr. Powell will then discuss upfront chemoimmunotherapy, and I will finish with PD-1, PD-L1 antibodies with other systemic therapies in advanced disease. So let's go ahead and get started.
Great. Thank you for that nice introduction. Welcome, everybody. Hope you enjoy your lunch also. So here are my objectives. We're going to be talking about molecular subtypes, review the implications for prognosis and therapeutic decision-making, look at biomarkers for response to immune checkpoint inhibitors, talk a little bit about BRCA1/2 and HRD in endometrial cancer, and then talk about guideline-endorsed approach to the assessment of other clinically relevant biomarkers. So we've been looking, and how do we determine stage in endometrial cancer or the prognosis in endometrial cancer? And we've been going by stage for the longest period of time in histology. And so here is a little bit of a breakdown of the different stages. We see that stage is still very prognostic. We see that histology is prognostic. Serous certainly does worse than the endometrioid group. But even within serous cancers, 10% of all endometrial cancers are serous cancer, but they represent for 40% of the death. There's HER2 overexpression or amplification of ERBB2 in 18 to 42% of the patients. And in this nice little study by Britt Erickson, they found that in stage 1 uterine cancer, 26% was HER2 positive. But they found that that was prognostic also. 50% recurrence rate in the patients that were HER2 positive versus about 17% of those HER2 negative, despite the fact that 70% of all these patients received chemotherapy. So HER2 is also associated with a worse prognosis and progression-free survival. But fortunately, we do have some drugs that we can target. We have the monoclonal antibodies trastuzumab and pertuzumab, and then ADCs, trastuzumab deruxtecan and trastuzumab pemirtecan, that we heard about this morning also. I think most of you are very, very familiar with this slide, so we don't have to spend a lot of time on it. But the TCGA was really where we learned that there is, within endometrial cancer, these different subset, poly-ultra-mutated, the MSI or hyper-mutated, copy number low or more endometrioid-like, and then the copy number high or more serous-like, and that these were associated with different prognosis, as you see on those Kaplan-Meier curves. But over time, this has gotten more complicated. We see in the middle there endometrial cancer, around the inner circle is the different molecular subtypes. There's more low grades on the left side, the high grades are on the right side, but then those are associated with different mutational patterns too. On the low grade, we see some mismatch repair deficiency, but P10 inactivation, ARID1A activation, the ERBB2, KRAS BRAF MEK pathway activation. We see more PIK3CA BCA, beta-catenin, FGFR on that side, whereas on the other side, the copy number high, we see more cyclin E amplification, P53 mutations, HER2, PP2R1A, and then now we have all these other factors too that we have to start thinking about. TROP2 expression, folate receptor alpha, B7H4, HRD, what does that mean? It's just getting more complicated, and while it's all endometrial cancer and these are all apples, they don't all behave the same. And PORTEC-3 is really the study that first taught us that these patients all respond different to treatment. Here's where we saw that it's really the P53 abnormal group that benefits from the addition of chemotherapy to over just radiation by itself, whereas poly and mismatch repair deficient groups, they did not benefit much from chemotherapy. We saw when we started to use immunotherapy, this worked really well in a mismatch repair deficient population where you had response rate between 40 and 50%, but it didn't work well at all in the mismatch repair proficient population where the response rates were in the low teens. And it makes sense. These tumors look different too. Here we see that both the poly, and that's in the plots here on the left, the poly and MSI are associated with higher increased predicted neoepitopes and number of CD3 positive and CD8 positive tumor infiltrated lymphocytes compared to mismatch repair stable tumors. And then these hypermutated tumors also have higher neoantigen loads and they have increased tumor infiltration cytotoxic T lymphocytes. So those are really the candidates that are good for immunotherapy. We've had these hot mismatch repair deficient tumors, but when we add chemotherapy to it, we are able to make these cold tumors, the PMMR tumors, a little bit more hot, and we still see responses now if you combine it to immunotherapy also. They're not all the same, and Dr. Powell will talk more about that. The question is, should we just add chemotherapy for all? No, we don't. We need to keep testing these molecular subtypes. Here's B21 as a good example of that, where the addition of pembrolizumab to chemotherapy improved the disease-free survival in the DMMR subgroup, which we see on the right, with a similar hazard ratio, 0.3. But actually, the curves are reversed in the PMMR subgroup, where the patients who received immunotherapy along with it, that's the red curve, and that's up top. So it doesn't work the same. We have to keep testing and decide where do we use these agents best. This is the Ruby molecular classification that has previously been presented by Dr. Coleman, Dr. Mirza at ESMO and ESMO GYN a couple years ago. And what they did is they used whole exome sequencing for the patients in this trial and divided them into four distinct molecular subsets. And on the right upper curve, we see the DMMR population. That was no surprise. We had already seen it, but that left bottom corner where we see the P53 mutated group, that was a bit of a surprise at the time, like 0.55 hazard ratio where the chemotherapy, if you added immunotherapy, they saw a lot of improvement. And I don't think at that time that many of us would have expected that. And interestingly enough, also, as we look at the overall survival follow-up data, we see those results are maintained and the differences are maintained. So there's something here that not every subset, even in the PMMR groups, responds the same. How about across trials? We see in MITO-N3 where they used avelumab. If you look at number C, that was in the mismatch repair mutated group, the curves are reversed. Actually, here is P53 mutations associated with a poor effect of avelumab. In DOE, we see hazard ratio is not as strong. In the highlighted P53 mutated, we see a hazard ratio is 0.8. But if you then add olaparib on top of the durvalumab, now we see a hazard ratio of 0.47. So what's going on with all these things? A couple more of these predictive biomarkers. PD-L1, can we use that? Well, in 0.18, not very predictive, we see here that the hazard ratios are similar whether you're PD-L1 positive or negative. But in DOE, that's a little bit different. Now we see that if you're positive by TAP score, you see a greater effect of the addition of immunotherapy, and that even gets greater if you have durvalumab and olaparib. HRR, also very difficult in this PMR population. We see that the patients with HRR, so homologous recombination repair mutations, they do a little bit is favored towards durvalumab, and if you add olaparib a little bit more. But we see that benefit also in a non-HRR mutated, and we see the effect also in the BRCA and in a non-BRCA. Similar in Ruby, we see the benefits, but the BRCA actually is too small numbers of BRCA mutations and HRR mutations. So in DUO-E, they did a really nice subset and kind of the molecular biomarkers that are available. We see that here. But one of the problems with all these individual biomarkers is that there's so much overlap between PD-L1, P53, the HRR. So they're hard to sort out which is really the strongest biomarker. And the additional problem is that we see variability in these biomarker assessments. We use different agents, a PD-1 versus a PD-L1. We use different forms of MMR testing. We have a PD-L1 antibody that's different between the different studies, different scoring system, a CPS versus TAP scoring. We use IHC for P53 or whole exome sequencing. The HRR panels that I talked about, most of those are Foundation Medicine panels that were used in those studies, and that's for 14 different HRR mutations. And then we have different populations on top of all of it, where, for example, the Asian population, we didn't even get to talk about that. So lastly, there's so much more that we could talk about, but lastly, I do want to touch about some of the ctDNA, which may not necessarily be a biomarker for response to immunotherapy, but it is here at least a prognostic biomarker that we may be able to use, but it looked to be prognostic across all the different treatment arms. So what are we left with as far as the assessment of clinically relevant biomarkers? Here's the graph from the figure from the NCCN guidelines. And slowly but surely, in addition to those four molecular subsets, we have this list that's building on the right-hand side, looking at doing this at initial evaluation, looking at TMB, HER2 we should be adding, ERPR, and then don't forget genetic counseling for these patients too. And are we using these moleculars? One thing here is this is from PORTEC 4A, which can be a little bit confusing as you try to analyze this, and definitely recommend that you do this in your journal clubs or something like that to take a deep dive. But here they added also beta-catenin as a biomarker. They added L1-CAM. We can just say from this study, how do we use this molecular profile, and that no adjuvant treatment is non-inferior to brachytherapy for vaginal control and the high intermediate risk endometrial cancer for the polymutated and the NSMP beta-catenin wild type group. So too much to go into this. So in conclusion, molecular profiling has prognostic and predictive implications. Across most subsets, there's benefit of the addition of IO in addition to chemotherapy. We still lack a strong predictive biomarker other than really MMR and MSI status, and we still have challenges. There's small subsets, there are variable methods of assessment, and we really need broader access to the clinical trial specimens so we can keep testing, and we need also support for new biomarker discovery. And with that, I may have left you with more questions, but I'll hand it over.
Great. That was amazing. Thank you. So we are now going to go to one of our videos with Dr. Matt Gelonis, who's going to present a patient case.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice. And to make this CME meeting more relevant and practical, I met separately with three noted clinical investigators, Professor Jonathan Lederman from the UCL Cancer Institute in London, United Kingdom, Dr. Ursula Matalonis from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and Dr. Angela Secord from the Duke Cancer Institute in Durham, North Carolina, to brainstorm about clinical scenarios and related research data sets in advanced endometrial cancer to present to the faculty for their input. To begin, Dr. Matalonis presented an older woman with de novo metastatic mismatch repair proficient metastatic endometrioid endometrial cancer treated in the pre-immunotherapy days.
She's 78 and 5 years ago developed postmenopausal bleeding. An endometrial biopsy was consistent with a high-grade endometrial cancer. She also had noticed some, maybe perhaps some mild shortness of breath. She's a very, very active lady. And the doc taking care of her at that time point did a chest, abdomen, pelvic CT scan showing innumerable bilateral lung nodules, right lung biopsy consistent with a high-grade endometrial primary. She did undergo a laparoscopic vaginal hysterectomy with a BSO. PATH showed a grade 3 endometrioid, endometrial cancer measuring 6 centimeters in largest diameter, and also pretty deeply invasive into the myometrium at 80%. Her NGS showed a TMB of 11. She was MMRP. She went on to receive 6 cycles of carboplatin and paclitaxel. This was before, obviously, the more general use of potentially adding an immunotherapy drug to carboplatin paclitaxel. So pretty remarkably, she's had a near CR. 5 years later, she is now without evidence of cancer and doing well and really thriving. The question to the panel, would you have added pembrolizumab or dostarlimab to carboplatin paclitaxel?
We all see cases like this. Dr. Powell, I'm going to start with you. So what are your thoughts on this case, and what would you do if you had this patient today?
Yeah, so these are tricky cases, and this one, obviously, somewhat the exception, did well. We'll review a little bit about GOG-209, where carboplatin paclitaxel by itself doesn't do very well. This group with her biomarker assessment with P53 mutation, as Dr. Backus just pointed out, seems to be a group where immunotherapy may be helpful. Now, again, we don't have all the data in yet. It's really frustrating. GY018, we probably won't have our translational science looking at the molecular subgroups till the end of the year. But I think we would certainly have a strong discussion about adding immunotherapy into this patient.
Yeah, and Dr. Backus, you talked about biomarkers. You know, ER negative, this patient was ER negative, which we know can be associated with a poor prognosis. What are your thoughts on this case, and what do you do when you see an ER negative case specifically?
I think for me, like this has two things, like ER negative and also grade 3, and we know that those are going to be less likely to respond to less likely to respond to hormonal therapy. So I would not have used that before now. Yes, with immunotherapy available, definitely would have done that. In this patient before, may have even considered adding bevacizumab or something like that in this P53 mutated patient. But she did well without and didn't have to go on maintenance. So this definitely we have to sort out. If we only could know.
Yeah, I think these are always challenging cases. Knowing today, I probably would have added immunotherapy with this advanced stage 4 patient, but the patient did remarkably well, and I think you're going to show the data of how actually poor the prognosis or outcomes are with carboplatin and paclitaxel alone. So sticking with the biomarker assessment, so patients with advanced endometrial cancer, we are looking at multiple different biomarkers. You mentioned P53. We didn't really talk too much about BRCA and HRRs in We don't really, I guess, use it so much in clinical practice, but you did mention in context of trials, and then you did talk about HER2 status. So how important is it for you to biopsy a metastatic or recurrent site versus using the primary tumor, or do you oftentimes test both, looking for any differences in tumors? I'll start with you, Dr. Backus.
So I think it is important because we know that these tumors, especially, that they can evolve over time. We can see responses in one part, and we can have something else that is persistent and that may be treated differently also. We have so many more options now. Repeating, I guess, in a lot of situations, like if the patient was HER2 positive, I probably wouldn't repeat. But if she was negative, yes, I definitely think that repeating a biopsy can be helpful to have another option for treating these patients in the future also.
Dr. Powell, anything to add?
No, I would agree. I think, up front, I don't think I would have biopsied the metastatic site, if it wasn't going to change my management, as you just said. But at relapse, I probably would be considering it. Certainly, we can see more HER2 as the tumor advances. If I have a target and it's already there, I probably won't retest. But if it's not there, I'll look for it.
Yeah, I agree. And there's in the breast cancer world, they'll often retest for HER2 status multiple times until it kind of declares itself. So I think we're learning more about endometrial cancer, but it's a very exciting area. I'm curious, you mentioned ctDNA, and I think it's such an emerging topic and such an important thing. I'm curious if you're using it in your practice today, Dr. Backus?
I struggle with it a little bit. I'm probably, I don't know if I'm making any friends with that, but it's hard. So I've had patients ask about it. So in those cases, I use it. The hard part is, what does it mean? Like if my patient is on a treatment and now she's ctDNA negative and it turns positive, I still don't really know if I need to treat her now or if that means that in 2 or 3 years from now I may need to start treatment. So I'm a little hesitant to sometimes to get that information because I don't really know if it's just helping me or helping the patient or causing more anxiety. It's nice to have that information available. It's more to maybe to de-escalate that it may help us than actually to say, when should we escalate?
Yeah, Dr. Powell, anything to add?
No, the only thing, you know, hopefully we'll have some evidence from your GY020 study for the earlier stage patients. Knowing whether we need 1, 2, 3 years of therapy would be great to know that, but it wasn't embedded and tested in our trials. But hopefully, as we learn more about those tumors that express circulating tumor, we can learn going forward. But I think it's a few years before I can recommend that for routine practice.
I agree, and it's interesting because I think that you mentioned de-escalation of treatment. I think that's kind of a very enticing opportunity to use ctDNA. But we do have, you know, this direct-to-consumer marketing, and so patients are often asking about it. And I think it's a little problematic because we're probably seeing some lead time bias if we're, you know, using it for treatments. That's what we're probably seeing in some of these studies. I think it's a really interesting emerging area, but I think it's still, you know, to be interpreted with caution. And we may be over-treating patients or treating them earlier than they really need. So next question I have for you guys is, are you conducting molecular analysis for all of your patients with endometrial cancer, early stage, late stage, or are you being selective in your approach? Matt?
No, we certainly do it for all. I mean, it may not all get polymerase epsilon testing, but in the cases where it would matter, especially clinical trial eligibility or some de-escalation approach, we will do it there. But understanding what their risk for Lynch syndrome and other issues still are important. We actually look at HER2 for everybody, just for what you showed with the HER2 in the serous population. Those that were positive have much worse outcome, and obviously to target them for directed trials like GY026.
Dr. Backus, are you doing poly testing universally? Or are you reserving it for select cases?
We just had another discussion with our pathology group is kind of where maybe other people are struggling too. We cannot do poly in-house, which is very difficult. So we do have to send all of these out for, and we don't have an in-house molecular, large molecular panel, at least there's a small one, but if you're going to test and you're going to pay the price, then we would have to send it out, or we do send it out for NGS testing with just one of the available companies.
And I apologize if I missed it. You do that for which patients?
We were working towards a strategy to do it for all, but I don't know. Do you guys do it for 1A grade 1?
No, not typically. And if they met higher intermediate risk criteria and we were targeting for the GY032 trial, then we would. But again, they kind of have to be higher intermediate risk. For the 1A ones, we're not doing that at this point.
There are some clinical pathologic features that you may find. So some of these like more aggressive looking tumors, but earlier stage, and our pathologists are so keen. They'll be like, hey, you may want to test this for poly. We can do it in-house, but we do it selectively. And I think that's been kind of informative. So hopefully we'll learn more as cost comes down, accessibility. So, you know, we all work with fellows, and I know there's some in the room. What do you do when a fellow asks you, what are the long-term outcomes with checkpoint inhibitor therapy? For, I think DMMR is pretty settled, but how do you explain to them with a PMMR population? Dr. Powell, what do you tell your fellows if they ask you this question?
Well, I was going to say for the DMMR, I'm actually presenting tomorrow our 4-year follow-up data on the RUBY trial, which does allow us to give an estimate if they make it to a year or longer, you know, what their risks of long-term survival. I'm not going to give it
previews.
Away, but I'm going to stick to the question. So PMMR, clearly, there are long-term survivors in that group, and it's certainly less. And as we put the whole molecular formula together, what their HER2 status is, what, obviously P53, the type of mutation may matter. We launched a trial looking at the addition of bevacizumab to the pembrolizumab and carboplatin paclitaxel, because we think there may be a role in our P53 mutated patients, especially that those that have a, what's called a gain of function mutation may be best served with the addition of bevacizumab to that backbone. So much like our four drug regimen in cervical cancer.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to close out. I'm just going to say, you know, I think it's a challenge. I think their chemotherapy is clearly not enough. And I think the role for a maintenance strategy is probably really important in these patients with advanced diseases. And so with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to Dr. Powell, who's going to talk to us about current upfront chemo and immunotherapy approaches for advanced endometrial cancer. Thank you.
All right. And I apologize in advance for the speed of these presentation, but all the slides are available. It's mostly to highlight some of the differences. Many of you have seen these trials. And as I mentioned, GOG-209, again, most of these patients had advanced measurable disease. There were non-measurable patients in within this. You know, you could say, well, it was a negative trial or non-inferior trial, but it did establish carboplatin paclitaxel to be our standard, but we didn't do very well. When you look at this overall survival, this is really a huge gap and a big room for improvement. As Dr. Backus mentioned, you know, we have that biomarker positive group that we're very excited about with DMMR, with high response rates. And then now 2 years ago, we had the big advances forward with GYO-18 and RUBY, and we'll be walking through these trials a little bit and really pointing out some of the differences in the trial, things we should be thinking about, but not necessarily rehashing the whole trial. GYO-18 came through the NRG. This was probably our best powered study as far as we had two molecular cohorts. We were starting to understand things a little better at that point. We know much more at this point. These patients had greater than 12 months chemo-free interval if they've had prior chemotherapy given adjuvantly, and you can see the breakdown. There was not carcinosarcoma included within this study, but you saw that dramatic differences in PFS in the DMMR population, but less so in the PMMR population, but still an improvement in that area. When we look at OS, much more modest. And you try to think, well, why are some of the differences when we come across these trials? Well, in the United States, where primarily this trial was run, we did have the opportunity to give immunotherapy much more readily than some of the other trials when the patient relapsed. There was also some a little more unblinding here. As you remember, this happened during COVID, so there was a fair amount of unblinding that happened early. Further updates in OS are coming, and here's one of them. And as I mentioned, the molecular cohorts are coming for GYO-18 as well. So we're constantly learning more from these trials over time. And as mentioned, some of that adjustment for post-IO study still shows a benefit of giving the checkpoint inhibitor with chemotherapy. I think that's probably important, that the chemotherapy is interacting with the immunotherapy to actually deliver better outcomes for patients. Giving it later probably isn't the same. When we look at the RUBY trial, which I was the U.S. lead for this study, we did involve carcinosarcomas as well as we involved some earlier stage patients, the stage 3 patients it could be included, the non-measurable stage 3C patients could be included if they were a non-endometrioid type. Again, this was followed with maintenance checkpoint or placebo for up to 3 years. Again, very similar shapes of the curves. The OS shown in the DMMR population with 0.3, and the OS in the overall population, again, differences in the way the statistics were done on the study, but that hazard ratio of 0.64 with that longer-term follow-up. When we look at the PMMR population specifically, again, meaningful differences, I think, wasn't powered to show this group like 018 was, but that a good strong trend towards OS benefit in the PMMR population. With the IA2 analysis, very similar findings and updates. And then, as Dr. Backus mentioned, the molecular subgroups. Now, this isn't how we would do it in our practice. This is whole exome sequencing. It wasn't P53 staining. So there may be some differences as we learn more about how these trials are done. Unfortunately, clinical trial specimens are so precious, we don't have all that information to share on this. But as Dr. Backus mentioned, we really had that molecular subgroup of poly all seem to do well. We really have to figure out whether we can de-escalate those patients in some way. And then the DMMR and P53 mutated populations seem to benefit most. The most puzzling thing for us was the NSMP population. And is there a subpopulation within NMSP that may be beneficial, like the ER negatives? We don't know that at this point. DOE, we're going to be talking more about in the next presentation as well, but this added not only the two arms that were in the other trials, but a third arm involving a PARP inhibitor with olaparib. And I'm not going to dive into this a lot, but one of the issues with the powering of this trial, it was all compared to the control group. It wasn't powered to look at the addition of olaparib to the IO chemo backbone. So interpreting what that additional value of olaparib is a little tricky. We see in the DMMR population, it sure doesn't seem to be adding much. But in the PMMR population, which again was about 80% of the trial, there was a trend towards benefit there with improvement, at least numerically, in PFS. And if you look across the subgroups, as already mentioned, with some of the biomarkers, you see some trends there that may be important. So when we think about kind of paradigm shifting data, we have a lot of information to put together. And this was some of the kind of the unique features of the trial. Then I'll kind of get into the good, bad, and the ugly on the next trial, on the next slide. But the unique features, again, with RUBY and DUO-E involved carcinosarcoma, different degrees of measurable disease within the trials. A little comment about measurable disease versus non-measurable. With the B21 data coming out showing that there wasn't a role in the PMMR population for giving checkpoint, and if you look at the subgroups within RUBY and 018 that didn't have disease, they didn't seem to benefit from adding immunotherapy. I think you probably need tumor around to educate the immune system. And we'll get into a little bit about neoadjuvant approaches and such as we go through this. But that's one of the things to keep in mind. Yes, they were eligible for the trial, but there's not a real strong signal when we look at the non-measurable patients. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of these things. And again, I'm not going to go through every trial, but to point out a few of the things. RUBY, one of the things we didn't do is power the MMR proficient group. We weren't actually, when we designed the trial, we had no idea what cohort of patients we would even get as far as the percentage of patients that had DMMR versus PMMR. 018, again, wasn't powered for OS. And when we look at RUBY Part 2, which Dr. Slaney is going to be talking a little bit more about, we were missing the middle arm, which was chemo ICI alone. We were hoping, given the trials were done in a somewhat timely fashion, that we'd be able to extrapolate, but it makes it really tricky with the changing landscape in just a few years that happened after we released RUBY and 018. DOE, one of the things we don't have with DOE yet is longer-term follow-up. The OS was only 28% mature when reported initially. That follow-up additional analyses are due to us soon. And as I mentioned, wasn't really powered to compare chemo IO with chemo IO PARP inhibitor. And as we now know with LiPo01, and we didn't present that today, but moving lenvatinib and pembrolizumab up front doesn't seem to be a strategy better than carboplatin paclitaxel, but still maybe an option for some of our patients. We anxiously await the C93 and Dominica trial, which I'll be reviewing a little bit more. But we did mention B21 earlier. And B21 is for our earlier stage patients, those that are truly receiving adjuvant therapy, kind of non-measurable population. And as Dr. Backus pointed out, really no difference in the groups other than perhaps what we see in the DMMR population. And this is where that conversation happens with patients. Is this enough for us to add in immunotherapy for this population? And again, it wasn't chemoimmunotherapy. Chemoimmunotherapy, but we have to look further. Is it worth that toxicity? When we mentioned P53, P53 seems to be a signal, and we don't know how best to use it yet. This is a trial designed to answer that question. This is now our follow-up to GY018 and an earlier trial we did called 86P, which really investigated the role of VEGF inhibition in endometrial cancer. And we found a unique population, as I mentioned, that had a gain-of-function P53 mutation seemed to benefit uniquely to the addition of bevacizumab. So we want to test this in this three-arm trial, which many of you are opening at your institutions now, looking at the triplet of carboplatin, paclitaxel, pembrolizumab versus pembrolizumab maintenance, a Bev-only arm, and then the four-drug regimen arm with both maintenance of pembrolizumab and bevacizumab. So this trial is opening. Again, it targets our highest-risk population. Our biggest population with disparities are Black and African-American patients, so we do think this will be a big step forward. And as I mentioned, this trial is not published yet, but this is looking at just chemo versus IO for a DMMR population. This is a completed accrual, but not yet data out, but hopefully we'll see these things soon. And similarly with the C93 study, looking at pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy. So more to learn, but as I mentioned, these trials don't have the triplet regimen as part of them. So there'll be further debate to talk about on stage in the future. I want to highlight a few things coming up. Our four-year survival, as I mentioned, it will be presented tomorrow for the RUBY trial, and other things out there. We saw this earlier, and some real-world evidence will be out in a poster session at this meeting as well. So our key takeaways, obviously molecular profiling is very important and really a new standard. There's a lot of things to sort out yet. We have different populations that didn't seem to benefit as well. And again, many unanswered questions that we hopefully will sort out as we gather more information, more real-world evidence from the molecular testing and how best to treat these patients. So thank you.
That was a fantastic overview. And you guys probably know that both of these folks on stage here lead clinical trials in endometrial cancer space. So I encourage you to ask questions. Please submit them. We'll be happy to answer them. They will be happy to answer them. Let's go ahead and go to our second video here with Dr. Secord.
Dr. Secord told me about a 68-year-old woman presenting with mismatch repair deficient metastatic disease.
She presented with postmenopausal bleeding, and she's diagnosed with a grade 1 endometrial cancer. She had a pelvic ultrasound that showed a fairly large uterus and a 3x2 centimeter mass on the cervix. On exam, this mass on the cervix seemed to go into the perimetry on the left side. So we ordered a PET CT that showed hypermetabolic activity, not only in the cervix and endometrium, but retroperitoneal adenopathy, right omental nodule, and right-sided pulmonary nodules, so really concerning. So her tumor testing was obtained, and she was deficient in mismatch repair, but now obvious metastatic and widespread disease. We initiated carboplatin and paclitaxel with IO therapy, and our plan was to re-image after 3 cycles. I just saw her the other day, and she has had a really great response, a strong partial response. And a question I have for the group is, do they have any preference in specific IO therapy? For instance, pembrolizumab, dostarlimab, or durvalumab? Do they think there's a difference in these different types of immunotherapeutic agents? And then in addition, would they treat differently based on the histologic subtype? So if this patient had a carcinosarcoma, would that lend them to more likely use dostarlimab? So you have such an esteemed panel there today, and Dr. Powell is the chair of the uterine committee at NRG. So I'd love to hear a commentary regarding GY018 and the design of this study compared to the RUBY study and DUO-E, and thoughts there in terms of the benefit of one IO therapy over the other and differences between the clinical trial eligibility. And specifically for the whole group, which data set looks stronger for you? And in totality, do you feel like there's a biologic rationale why one IO agent would be preferred over the other?
So leave it to Dr. Secord to ask 100 questions in one. I'm going to actually start with our first question, because I think we all discussed this with PARP inhibitors when they first came out. Dr. Powell, do you think there's a difference between the specific checkpoint inhibitors? And maybe you can break it up PD-1 versus PD-L1 or take them individually.
Yeah, I think, you know, I like your approach on the PD-1 versus PD-L1. You know, when we look at the single agent activity, there does seem to be more activity in the PD-1s over PD-L1 in endometrial cancer. Again, small series, not well controlled, no cross cross-trial comparison. The only head-to-head trial we have is in lung cancer, where dostarlimab did seem to do slightly better. Well, actually, was statistically better. But we don't have that in endometrial cancer, and I really hesitate on cross-trial comparison. I think the area that she mentioned with carcinosarcoma was included. 10% of the patients within the RUBY trial were carcinosarcoma. Most of those were in the P53 group, but not all, which, again, one of those lessons that not all carcinosarcomas are treated the same. They do seem to, again, we're in the RUBY trial, so I would probably follow the trials and use dostarlimab in that group.
Yeah, Dr. Backus, same question, but do you see any difference in toxicities as well?
Not so much, honestly. I think dostarlimab, pembrolizumab are probably much more used under valemap here. But I think overall, like the schedules are the same now. Obviously, the 6-week scheduling we're now also used to. Certainly, the dostarlimab has a little bit more data in that space for giving every 6-week dosing, but we're doing it across all the different drugs. So schedule doesn't really make a difference. I don't see, personally, like a ton of difference there. It's hard to predict which patient's going to get the toxicity, too.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more preferential to the PD-1 inhibitors. And I think when you look at the studies, you know, we didn't talk about a 10 trial, which is using atezolizumab, another PD-L1. And the PMMR group really didn't see a difference. And I just feel like the PD-1 may be a little bit more potent. And this is just me speaking on my own like belief. But I definitely don't see a difference between the PD-1s individually. And I agree, toxicities kind of have been similar.
I think it is still important, though, to think about it, too. Like, the populations were just very different, too. Fair. Like, the PD-L1 patients, the studies with the PD-L1 patients all had many more Asian patients, as Dr. Powell just pointed out. So is it the PD-L1 or is it the population that we're testing? So it's hard. Like, we're never going to see it head-to-head, but yes.
Great point.
There are differences.
There are differences, and I think you're right about patient population, which I know, Matt, I might go by it between first names and last names, forgive me. Dr. Powell, you spoke a little bit about kind of disparities when you were talking about, you know, higher-risk histologies. And speaking of histologies, how do you interpret subtypes? Does that influence your decision on which specific, we'll just stick with dostarlimab and pembrolizumab in the since those are the ones more commonly used. And you said 2 years. Can you believe it's actually been 3 years?
Oh, my, yeah, it was 2023,
I know, like,
yes,
when you get
I
older,
did.
Time flies.
Yeah, thanks for correcting.
So when you have a patient with carcinosarcoma, does that influence your choice? And as the RUBY PI, like, I'd love to hear your point, because you did actually intentionally include that in the trial.
Yeah, so it does, you know, again, we would kind of follow the guidance from the trial and use the dostarlimab in that group with carcinosarcoma. As far as subtype, though, you know, a lot of this is just hypothesis generating. You know, it's not perfect. The whole exome sequencing data, as I mentioned, has some holes in it. We do hope to have a more robust translational science coming out with 018. And hopefully, as we put all that information together, we'll learn more, especially when it comes to how do you put HER2 in the mix here? When do you choose to use a HER2 agent versus an immunotherapy mm-hmm. agent?
Yeah, Dr. Backus, anything to add about histology?
You're
pretty consistent with the guidelines.
I agree.
Yeah. And I just want to highlight, you know, Dr. Powell was actually very instrumental in carcinosarcoma work that actually kind of showed it works really kind of like an epithelial cancer and kind of breaking that mentality of a sarcoma. So I think it's really pivotal work, and I think it's important that we do include these histologies as we move forward, but that's just my opinion. We actually have some questions that came from the audience. I'm going to pivot a little bit. So, you know, in PMMR, advanced stage uterine cancers, are you strongly recommending the addition of IO? And I actually liked how you talked about HER2. So can you break it down for us, Dr. Powell, about how you maybe strategize on what you're using, kind of knowing that trials are pending?
Right. So again, you mentioned there was kind of 4 molecular subgroups. There's really probably 8 or more mm-hmm. as we think about, you know, what HER2 does, what HER2-1 means, what it means in low grade. As we mentioned within the NSMP population, we can break that down to the ER positives and negatives seems to be a good risk breakthrough. I'm more hesitant on always recommending checkpoint for our NSMP group. I think that's the group right now I probably feel the most uneasy about with the translational science from RUBY.
Yeah, and that's, I think, very provocative, because I think it comes to our next question. You know, the OS data may trend towards survival benefit in the PMMR group with the addition of checkpoint inhibitors, but statistically, it may not be as significant. So Dr. Backus, how do you juggle using IO frontline or saving it for second line with lenvatinib and pembrolizumab?
I think this is really tricky because we have phase three data. But on the other hand, for these patients, it's easy if the patient is not eligible to receive immunotherapy. And if they have an autoimmune disease or some other reason that you may be a little bit more hesitant to use it. But for a patient who is a candidate, I don't think we really know the answers yet. It would be great. But the studies that we did using it in second line, and then we're talking about lenvatinib, pembrolizumab, none of those patients were pre-treated with IO. It worked, but we compared it to chemotherapy and not chemotherapy with IO. In those patients, we didn't see much of a difference there between chemotherapy and len-pem. So that doesn't, and while it's a negative trial, it doesn't mean that len-pem doesn't work. It works pretty similar to carboplatin and paclitaxel. So I think that's a very reasonable approach. If they've had prior chemotherapy, now it gets even more complicated.
Yeah, my dream is that we are better able to strategize the patients who are not DMMR or MSI and have better maintenance strategies. And then lenvatinib, pembrolizumab, or other IO combinations in IO-naive population may be more relevant. And I think, you know, you mentioned that it happened during the pandemic, and that's one of the reasons we unblinded patients, so they didn't have to come in unnecessarily. But we also had lenvatinib and pembrolizumab approved at that time, so when patients recurred, they could go on that. And I think the GY018 data really had probably a high percentage of patients who received IO afterwards, and you showed some of that data. So I'm curious now, you know, you talked about a little bit of the design and the eligibility criteria different. You had that beautiful slide, which I don't know if you made that, but kudos, because that's pretty fantastic. You know, how do you interpret these studies? And I'm not trying to do a head-to-head comparison, because we know that's wrong. But what do you think are like the big takeaways from maybe the big trials, GY18, O18, RUBY, and DUO-E, which we're kind of using practically in the United States?
You know, I think the big thing is there was consistency amongst the trials in the DMMR population. We can all feel very comfortable that that's probably the right thing to do is adding checkpoint in the DMMR population. When it looks at PMMR, and again, PMR is not all created equal, I think interpreting that is tough. And I wouldn't beat myself up if I decided not to give that patient immunotherapy. As we just mentioned, you have a fallback with an immunotherapy regimen with the lenvatinib pembrolizumab. But more information is coming. We'll have more clarity. Hopefully a year from now, we can come up here and tell you the exact answer to that question.
So I'm going to pivot a little bit for you, Dr. Backus. So we know that DMMR answered, right, for the most part. Maybe we can do better, but we have a pretty good answer. Now, if you have a patient who's PMMR and HER2 positive, how are you balancing using maybe trastuzumab in the frontline with chemotherapy followed by trastuzumab maintenance? I know there's a trial pending, so hopefully we'll get those results in the near future, but versus using immunotherapy where we have kind of phase three data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw some fellows in the room, so we debated, and we kind of go 1 week, it's one answer, and the next week, 2 weeks later, we do the same case, basically, and somebody else favors something else. So, a full disclosure. I think the trastuzumab is, you know, we have so many active agents now. That was phase two data, small populations. Yes, the patients that did not have prior chemotherapy in that group were included there, but it was still not exactly the same population as the GY18 or the RUBY populations. For me, if we have a phase three, typically I'll go with immunotherapy at this point over trastuzumab. We don't know how long to continue it, but hopefully really is where we need to put these patients on. I feel very comfortable putting these patients on trial so that they get targeted therapy and they still have options afterwards. So yes, please finish GY026 so we'll know.
And Dr. Backus is the PI on the TPAM trial that you heard a little bit about today. What do you think about trastuzumab and IO combinations? There's no data for this. Endometrial cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly something that needs to be looked at. There are some combinations now looking at trastuzumab deruxtecan with the addition of immunotherapy, even in the upfront setting now as a trial that's been launched. So more to learn. Again, we don't know how the HER2-positive patients did within the large immunotherapy trials. So that's more information that we'd like to see. Unfortunately, there's, you know, wasn't routinely done as clinical practice at that point for HER2 testing, so that wasn't available on all patients. And the translational science, as you know, needs lots of slides, and as we try to put these together, we don't have that. But we will hopefully have that on GY18.
Great. Thank you. Well, we have another video for you featuring Dr. Letterman.
One of the most exciting recent developments in oncology has been the use of immunotherapy in localized MSI-high cancers, including the groundbreaking research from Memorial Sloan Kettering on the use of primary dostarlimab without surgery for rectal cancer. The initial Memorial work had only one patient with endometrial cancer, and when I met with Dr. Letterman, the first thing I queried him about, and also would like to hear about from the faculty, was an upfront trial being conducted at his institution on the use of immunotherapy in localized MSI-high endometrial cancer.
Colleagues in our institute are leading an international study of neoadjuvant IO in patients with endometrial cancer. So two cycles before they actually have surgery to actually look at the biological effect of IO on the endometrium when it comes to surgery. So I think there's a lot of interest in taking this forward. I think there's clearly a hope that one day we may be able to dispense with the chemotherapy, which we know in these often elderly and comorbid patients is quite toxic, carboplatin paclitaxel. But we need to understand the real activity of these drugs. And I think in that neoadjuvant space is one way of doing that.
Dr. Powell, you mentioned Dominica and C93, which are looking at a single-agent checkpoint inhibitor versus carboplatin and paclitaxel. You also kind of mentioned the challenge of it not having the chemo IO arm. But what do you think, if those studies are positive, how would that inform your practice, or how would that change your practice?
I think it's certainly going to depend on the magnitude of benefit is going to be the big issue about, you know, is that population the right one to go without chemotherapy? It's already changed my practice a bit. As patients with DMMR disease start to get bad neuropathy, I'm probably a little quicker to de-escalate their taxane. Those type of things, you know, you'd see that happening because you feel like that immunotherapy is doing the bulk of the work for those patients. I still think, you know, when we look at RUBY, 71% of the patients in the DMMR cohort went on to get, or in the placebo side of the DMMR cohort went on to get immunotherapy, yet there's still a big difference in survival. So single agent IO, at least following chemotherapy, may not be as good. Just a lot of room for debate.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was also, you know, in the study that showed the provocative responses, the endometrial cancers in a larger series, I can't remember where it came from, didn't have as pronounced of a response. You didn't see that 100%. Dr. Backus.
Yeah, so that was a study from the Netherlands, but it was a small group, but they were, yes, I was not involved. But a lot of those patients did not have a complete response. And so there's actually a really interesting post, I'm going to put a plug in here for one of our fellows, Julia Tillif, had a poster, and we have a group of about over 50 patients where we looked at the patients that still had a uterus in place and truly got just regimen for metastatic disease, we left the uterus. While they had a beautiful response oftentimes outside the uterus in the omentum and a peritoneum, I'm hearing a lot of discussion, oh, we're going to leave the uterus in place. They had a complete response. But we actually typically in our practice still go back to remove the uterus. And we've had one PMMR patient in the whole group, one PMMR patient, not a DMMR, who had a true complete response. Oh. Everybody else had still residual disease in the uterus. So I don't think we're quite there. And there's something different about the uterine environment, that it's resistant, and who knows, it has to be, I mean, at the unique purpose of the uterus probably. but I don't think we're quite ready to just stop doing hysterectomy necessarily if there's a complete response. I would be a little bit careful with that at this time.
Yeah, and I think it was last year at SGO where they presented neoadjuvant or primary immunotherapy in advanced endometrial cancers, and they had some pretty impressive responses. So it was pretty exciting. But I caution, because how do you surveil these patients? Are you still doing endometrial biopsies? What's the rate of recurrence? You know, there's also thoughts of, can we use this for fertility instead of hormones in patients who are DMMR? I think we have a lot to learn. I think it's a really exciting area. And I think Dominica and C93 have some... they will be informative in one way or another.
Can I just make one comment?
Absolutely.
To that effect? So we've entertained three or four concepts over the last five, 6 years on this early stage endometrial cancer, giving IO in the DMMR cohort. You know, as we know, the big challenge we have is deciding who's at high enough risk to warrant the toxicity of giving an adjuvant therapy. Yes, immunotherapy is quite well tolerated, but some people do quite poorly. So balancing that, we don't have good enough imaging to tell us really who those 3C1s are that have small 2-millimeter mets. We don't have a great way of assessing that patient and where that risk-benefit ratio happens. And so you could say, well, you guys have been, you know, slow in uptake on this neoadjuvant approach. No, we haven't. We've been working on it greatly, but we really trying to balance toxicity and that we would have with implementing immunotherapy for these patients versus getting a hysterectomy data and then seeing what we have. Now, we have to respond to some other data that is maturing soon, so more to come.
Yeah, and I think Dr. Letterman's trial, they are all getting surgery afterwards, so I think it will also be helpful. I wanted to ask both of you just really quickly, IO after IO, we've talked about moving it up frontline, doing it for, you know, many of these patients. When, Dr. Backus, when do you rechallenge patients with immunotherapy?
So patients that have, where I've had more successes if the patient has completed immunotherapy and they're off for a while and have another recurrence later on, similar as really with any drug. If you don't progress on the drug, there may be able to an opportunity to restart again. IO after IO, do you combine it? I mean, I know some of this short, smaller studies that add lenvatinib or something like that, but it's probably a combination of something. What is the right combination to do this again, and is it necessary? It's great that we have other opportunities too, that we don't always have to do IO after IO, but we can we have all these other ADCs and other different oral agents and other hormonal agents that still may be an opportunity too.
Yeah, great. Dr. Powell, any other thoughts?
The only thing I would point out, when we designed GYO25, which is the ipi-nivo versus nivolumab trial, we deliberately put in a cohort that would have IO after IO, so they could previously had it. Now, unfortunately, it was a 12-month interval from their last IO to the next, but it was the one group that the experts at the NIH said, this is probably the group this IO after IO is going to work in, is a DMMR population. Because it's an evolving tumor, those tumors may look to need re-education with the immune system with further checkpoint. And, you know, when I... we'll talk about it a little bit tomorrow when I present the longer-term RUBY data in the DMMR cohort. It does seem to be that these patients can have small recurrences but still do quite well even, you know, a year or two after their IO therapy. So I think that definitely is a population. In the PMMR, I know a lot of people looking at lenvatinib and pembrolizumab and see responses, and I think, you know, more to come there. Hopefully that will continue to be one of our tools that we can use, but better things are available.
Yeah, and I'll add one thing to that. So it's not really a true IO after IO, but we also see in this situation, like a recurrence on IO, that it's just an isolated site. All the disease is controlled, but there's a recurrence in one single focus in the lung or one lymph node in the periaortic region or something like that. That's more like a keep somebody on IO, but I'm going to radiate that other target. And so we still, or maybe even remove it, whether it's with surgery, obviously it would be with surgery then, but you can do another intervening strategy and it becomes kind of IO after IO, but you just keep them on, yeah, with spot treat. And so yeah, I think that is a very important
thing. I like
that
too. For patients with mixed response too. I'll use that often.
Well, I do feel like we've changed the pattern of recurrence a little bit. I mean, anecdotally,
yeah,
where, you know, more of these localized therapies are needed.
Yep. Great. Thank you, guys. That was great. And keep your questions coming. I'm going to actually talk to you about the very last topic here in our formal discussion. And really, I want to review the role of PARP inhibitors. You heard about it a little bit in the earlier talks, but kind of what is the synergy with PD-1, PD-L1? Why did this even come up as a topic? I also want to discuss some of the long-term findings with pembrolizumab and lenvatinib. We've talked about kind of maybe how that role is shifting in our practices. And then lastly, I want to talk about bevacizumab. Now, Dr. Powell stole a little bit of my thunder, but I'll try to make it up to you guys. So, you know, leveraging the immune checkpoint, I think, is something that we commonly talk about. We know that immune checkpoint inhibitors with radiation therapy may play a role. Dr. Backus is actually doing a study on GY020, which is looking at early stage patients. And, you know, you hear about the Scopel effect, release of new antigens, which can make kind of the combination more powerful. You've already heard about chemotherapy and the role of immunotherapy, so I won't belabor that. But what I really want to focus on is what's the role of immunotherapy and anti-VEGF therapies, really looking at bevacizumab. You heard about the trial. There is some thoughts that this kind of increases antigen presentation, T-cell infiltration, trafficking, making for a more robust chemotherapy or treatment response. And then PARP inhibitors. Once again, you may have upregulation of stimulatory cell surface receptors, making that response more robust. So we're going to explore this a little bit more, and almost everything I'm talking about is going to be off-label. So, you know, this kind of came from phase 2 data, and so you had talazoparib and avelumab, 35 patients, all mismatch repair proficient. And you can see this waterfall plot, not as impressive as some of the ones we saw earlier today, but about 11.4% response rate. So a signal, and these were all recurrent patients. The DOMEC trial looked at durvalumab and olaparib. So this was kind of the foundation for DUO-E, which I'll spend a little bit more time talking about. 55 patients, 20% were DMMR, and you saw a 16% objective response rate. So maybe something that we thought was provocative. And so this really led to the DUO-E trial, which was looking at chemotherapy with platinum and taxane, with the addition of durvalumab, with or without placebo, and then also another arm with olaparib. You've already heard about the immunotherapy impact in PMMR and DMMR, so I'm really going to focus on that third arm, durvalumab and olaparib in combination here. And as Dr. Powell mentioned, I think it's really important that when we read these trials, we can get excited about things, but sometimes a statistical endpoint may not be actually represented as clearly as, you know, it should be. So here you can see both the progression-free survival and the overall survival. And as he mentioned, you know, the durvalumab olaparib arm was compared to the control arm of carboplatin paclitaxel, not to the durvalumab chemotherapy arm. And this is important because it sometimes muddies the water about what's the contributing, you know, component from the immunotherapy versus the contribution from the PARP inhibitor. So you have to take these in context. But what you can see is both at 12 months and 18 months, you do see a little bit of a difference between those patients who receive durvalumab and olaparib versus those who receive durvalumab alone, and clearly superior to the patients who receive just carboplatin and paclitaxel. You see the same trend kind of carrying on to overall survival, but a little less of a robust difference between these two groups. And so the durvalumab olaparib was statistically significant when compared to carboplatin paclitaxel alone. When you look at these subgroups, so you know, you heard this a little bit earlier, the DMMR population, I think you can probably safely say olaparib really didn't add anything to those patients, and we really shouldn't be using PARP inhibitors in those patients. Now, the PMMR, which is a majority of this group, 80% of this cohort, you do see a little bit of a signal difference here. So you can see at 12 months, about a 60% response rate compared to about a 44% response rate, kind of lingered over into that 18-month response rate. Not meant to be compared to durvalumab alone, but you can kind of, you know, we all do this. We all kind of look at these little details. And so you can see a little bit of a signal. So maybe there is some synergistic component between the PARP and durvalumab. It would have been great if we had an olaparib-only arm in this, so we could really tease out the differences. Always hindsight, it's always easy to criticize these clinical trials in retrospect. I know a lot of work goes into this, and this landscape was changing as, you know, we were getting these data, so it's a really hard thing to do. And then once again, here's the overall survival, kind of shows that same trend. Maybe a little less kind of separation between the durvalumab, olaparib, and durvalumab arms, but clearly you're seeing a difference with the overall survival. I think when we all saw this result, we're like, well, what really is the contribution of the olaparib? We really just didn't know. And let's skip through this here. But I'm going to go through the molecular profile. And you saw this slide earlier, and I think this is a really cool slide. I'm sorry for my circle being a little off. You know, we don't know what some of these markers really mean in endometrial cancer. You know, I always hear people talk about, oh, she has PD-L1 expression in endometrial cancer. I don't really care, right? To me, that just actually isn't meaningful. HRR, have we ever looked at that in endometrial cancer? Is that really important? People talk about HRD status. We get this in NGS testing. Is that something that's meaningful in endometrial cancer? These are all things we just really don't know yet. What I wanted to highlight from that circle was actually the TP53 mutation. This is actually a big portion of this cohort. And so maybe there might be certain groups that we see. There have been other studies that have kind of signaled out that maybe these P53 mutated tumors are more responsive to PARP inhibitors. So I think that may be a group. I think we need more data though, right? It's hard to make that leap just from this data, teasing out subgroups, right? I always joke that you could take all the redheads in the trial and say, oh, they have a better response to olaparib. It's not really meaningful, right? So we have to kind of use this in context. And then there's Ruby part two. So dostarlimab and niraparib. And this trial was also kind of designed to look at what's the contribution of PARP inhibitors. Once again, I don't know that we got the answer to this question because there was no niraparib-only arm. This was also done at the time where you had DMMR patients included on this because we hadn't yet proven that the DMMR population has such a great response to IO therapy. So it's a little bit muddy here. And here you can see the PFS in the overall population. So this was just two arms, dostarlimab and niraparib with chemotherapy. And then niraparib was, of course, post-chemo IO versus chemotherapy alone with no maintenance therapy. And so here you can see that there is a separation, 12 months, 57 versus 33.7%. Great. I don't know how to interpret this, so no offense, Matt. So it's just one of those things where it just leaves you for a little bit wanting a little bit more. You know, what was the contribution of PARP inhibitors? Which patients actually benefited from this? So I think we need to tease this out a little bit more. I do sincerely believe that PARP inhibitors probably play a role in certain patients with endometrial cancer. I'm just not smart enough to know which patients those are at this time. And so when you look at it by PMMR status, by MMR status, you can see in the proficient mismatch repair group, you do see that difference in these groups, and you can see that this shows a signal. In the DMMR population, you also see that signal, but I would argue that that's probably carried by the dostarlimab and really not the niraparib contributing much to this. You know, I did not include the overall survival, so we'll touch upon that in the questions, but we'll talk a little bit more about that with Ruby Part 2. And here's some molecular subgroups. And I just like to highlight this, that they say, hey, yeah, dostarlimab niraparib kind of favored all the subgroups here. And subgroup analysis is just kind of provocative. You know, don't use it for interpretation because we don't really have it. Patients kind of fall in multiple different buckets. But you can see here, BRCA mutation status. Hey, if I see that, yeah, PARPs become more appealing to me, I would admit. HRR mutation status, I don't know. And then you heard a little bit about the molecular subgroups when we think about the TCGA classifications. So you can see the breakdown here. DMMR, not surprisingly, because those patients received dostarlimab. Maybe that was also driving the TP53 mutation. Maybe not. So I think this study maybe gave me more questions than answers. I'm going to quickly go through lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. You've heard about this. This is looking at it in the recurrent setting. And here you can see, just kind of get to the punch of it, progression-free survival and overall survival advantage, not something that we saw with chemoimmunotherapy up front. So I think this still plays a role in certain patients. And you can see a much higher objective response rate, almost doubling that in those patients. But what is its role in patients who've received prior immunotherapy? Not answerable today. So the last thing I want to focus on is TP53 mutations. We know, just like you heard about HER2, this is also a biomarker for prognosis. When you look at GOG86P, you can see those patients who had P53 wild type versus those who had P53 mutation did better. And that's not something surprising. And we know that with copy number high, which typically is the P53 group, you can see that the prognosis is significantly impacted. And so when you look at certain subgroups in other trials, dostarlimab and bevacizumab from that 86P, it looked like these patients actually did derive some benefit from the addition of either dostarlimab or bevacizumab in those P53 mutation groups, where you can see kind of a separation of the survival curves. And so this kind of lends itself to that hypothesis-generating concept. And this is why we have this trial that Dr. Powell mentioned earlier, GY035, where we're looking at carboplatin paclitaxel pembrolizumab with pembro maintenance, carboplatin paclitaxel bev with bev maintenance, or the quadrant regimen. Kind of like what we do with cervical cancer, right? So we feel comfortable using it. We'll just see if this really has that synergistic effect. And so I think it's really important, you know, I don't need to say this, molecular testing should be integrated into routine practice, but stay up to date, because I think it's changing, you know, as we're getting new agents, new targets, both in the frontline and recurrent setting. And I think the PMMR, I'm still going to argue that I think this, the role of immunotherapy is less clear in those patients. And I think we have to really figure out who benefits from a PARP inhibitor, because those are not non-toxic. Who benefits from bevacizumab, and how can we use this better? But I think the most provocative thing is these new trials that are coming out, new ADCs, new targets, WEE1 inhibitors. So the future, I think, is really bright. So let's go to our video with Dr. Matulonis.
Dr. Matulonis was curious about the faculty's input on a 68-year-old woman with a previous history of robotic-assisted laparoscopic hysterectomy, BSO, and pelvic lymphadenectomy for a grade 1 MMR-proficient endometrioid endometrial cancer, after which she received no adjuvant therapy.
She remained without evidence of cancer until about 4 years later, when she presented with abdominal discomfort and was diagnosed with a 5-centimeter port site recurrence. The mass was biopsied, found to be consistent with a grade 1 ER-positive endometrioid cancer, consistent with her previous cancer. And she also was thought to have pelvic adenopathy, which was pretty small, but thought to be malignant. And this port site mass was surgically resected. Postoperatively, she received carboplatin, paclitaxel, and dostarlimab with follow-up scans showing NED. However, she developed some neuropathy of hands and her feet, some difficulty with knitting and sewing. About a year into the dostarlimab maintenance treatment, she developed recurrence with new enlarged right external iliac lymph nodes, abdominal wall mass, as well as a vaginal cuff mass. She entered on to one of our CDK4/6 inhibitor trials plus an aromatase inhibitor at Dana-Farber. And after 4 cycles of being on the CDK4/6 inhibitor plus the AI, she had a near complete response. And she's been on the trial for 3 years and is currently a CR by RECIST 1.1 and without evidence of any cancer. So I'm starting to think about when to think about taking her off.
So I've got to say, wow, interesting.
Yeah, I know. It's a pretty cool case.
Did she have a ctDNA, or are you going to do one?
We've not been checking. She's not part of the studies that are getting ctDNA, but that would be something else to consider. Absolutely.
Wow. Dr. Matulonis has amazing responses in our patients. So let's just think about post-surgical adjuvant therapy. So grade 1 PMMR patients, early stage, I think, does your approach differ from patients with grade 1 DMMR, early stage disease? Dr. Backus, I'm going to start with you since you have a trial kind of looking at this.
Is this for recurrence or for primary?
This is primary, sorry. This is post-surgical.
Okay. Well, data are going to have to be fully mature and presented, so I can't give you any scoops yet. But we do need that data. We need the data because these are grade ones. In a recurrent setting, I think it's a no-brainer. Yes, you're going to use immunotherapy where for grade one MS, grade one particularly, hormonal therapy is going to be really important. If this is an early stage, would I use endocrine therapy at that point as adjuvant treatment?
Let's say in the recurrent setting.
Okay.
Let's say it's recurrent now, just like Dr. Matulonis' case where she used a CDK4/6 inhibitor.
So would I have so I think probably the time when you could have made that decision would have been at the time when she had her mass resected. I mean, personally, I probably would have biopsied the lymph node, and I may have done nothing if you've resected that, and I may consider radiation if you're worried about positive margins, and then see what happens, because these patients may not need it, and now she's committed to it and has, obviously, toxicity for it. And if you want to do something, then I think this is also a good population to put these patients on hormonal therapy. And I have... adding to like good stories, I have these patients, and I think we all have these patients in our practice where you give them carboplatin, paclitaxel, and I just have stable disease, and nothing really changes. And then they have a little bit of progression, and you switch them to and progesterone or an aromatase inhibitor in combination with something else, but even just a progesterone by itself, and now they start responding. And it's slow. They oftentimes need to be on trial, like she was explaining, for a longer period of time to get to that CR, but this is definitely that group where I would not quickly jump to chemotherapy, and radiation is here an option too.
I'm going to pivot a little bit because we have a question from the audience about the role of radiation in advanced uterine cancer. And Dr. Powell, I'm going to ask you, you know, we've talked a lot about the advances in systemic therapy. When do you use radiation therapy, either alone or in combination with chemotherapy in these patients?
It's a great question. And I think one of the things that we've learned is as we look at our molecular subgroups, you know, obviously we have the PORTEC-3 data. We have the translational science now that's out for GOG-249, translational science out for 258. None of it tells the full story, but it does look like the group that seems to benefit from radiation is actually our NSMP group. So this is really our ER-positive breast cancer, like most cancer, where radiation seems to be important. Does that, what risk level do you think about radiation? It's also our group with kind of tends to have smoldering type cancer, where you have time to make these decisions. And, you know, if you make the wrong decision, you know, as in or hormone therapy doesn't work, it's, you usually haven't, you know, caused yourself too much trouble because you have opportunities to do more things. As patients can live a long time, even with small volume disease. But that the radiation really that I think about is in our NSMPs. With GOG-258 being a negative trial, as in radiation for everybody, didn't help. And if you look at PORTEC-3, it's really the group in PORTEC-3 that seemed to benefit from the addition of chemotherapy to pelvic radiation was really all the patients that were in 258, you know, the stage threes, the higher grade tumors. So we've really pulled back on the amount of adjuvant radiation we give. But I would agree with Dr. Backus on the case that Ursula presented. I would have given that patient radiation, to address these pelvic lymph nodes before I would probably give carboplatin, paclitaxel, and immunotherapy.
Yeah, great. You know, we talked a little bit about HER2 and other biomarkers that have kind of already got their foot in the door. What about some of these other biomarkers? Do you ever test for ESR1, which is used in breast cancer, PIK3K, AKT, P10? Anything else that you guys are, CCNE1, anything else you guys are testing for? Even talk about even clinical trials.
Yeah, I think these are all, we have targeted options for PIK3CA mutations, ACT pathway, the RAS-RAF MEK pathway, so in clinical trials. Can you get them later in line sometimes? Can you get them off-label? There are drugs that are targeted, alpelisib, for example, and there's a clinical trial that I think Stephanie Gaillard's leading in combination with hormonal therapy, but even as a single agent, if you're later down the line, you don't have that clinical trial available, it's that's okay to try too as a single agent. So yes, I'm certainly a strong believer in clinical trials. We should put the patient on it if that's available. But you've now gone through all of this. But yeah, we get this. If we all mm-hmm. order NGS, we have these mutations available and we just need to make it a good habit of looking back at what's out there and what targeted drugs can you use on or off label.
Dr. Powell, anything to add?
Just to comment on the ESR1, I know Dr. Secord had a small series looking at ESR1 and endometrial cancer where, you know, they patients went on to fulvestrant and did well after a prior failure of other hormonal regimens. And again, a lot of our hormonal regimens don't last very long. Adding the CD46, we seem to get more durable responses. We're hopefully going to be launching a large study in advanced endometrial cancer that's ER-positive and SMP type for patients looking at CD46 plus AI versus AI alone. So, and it's going to be one of our pragmatic trials, so easy monitoring, easy to put them on. And that trial is actually with palbociclib.
Yeah, and we also have things like WEE1 or small molecule inhibitors coming on in the pipeline in endometrial cancer, looking at, you know, CCNE1 targets. So I think this is a really exciting space. One area we haven't talked about is alpha folate receptor targets, and so we know there's been some phase 2 data on those. Have you guys had any experience using alpha folate receptor drugs in this space?
We did mirvetuximab with rucaparib several years ago as an IIT. The hard part with some of the mirvetuximab data is, or the requirements to get patients on, is that they have to be folate receptor high. And so those are mostly the folate receptor high in endometrial cancer end up being the serous. So I think we screened over 100 patients to get 25 patients on trial. And that was for ovarian and endometrial cancer. But it, I think that's a barrier. But some of these other ones, newer folate receptor alpha targeting drugs do not require a certain level. So that opens a whole new space.
Yes, yeah, so stay tuned.
This will be promising.
Well, let's go to our final video here with Dr. Letterman.
Dr. Letterman has had an integral role in clinical trials evaluating PARP inhibitors in ovarian cancer, and I was curious about his perspective on the evolving use of these agents combined with chemotherapy and immunotherapy in clinical trials of endometrial cancer.
There are two studies that come to mind. There's the DUO-E study, which combined chemotherapy and durvalumab with the addition in one arm of olaparib. And the second one was a trial called RUBY Part 2, which was a trial with chemotherapy and dostarlimab, and then the patients were randomized to the addition of niraparib or not.
Is that a strategy you've used or would use in any particular situation?
I'm not convinced. You know, I think it's a small benefit. I think we have to wait for the final OS data. I'm not sure when they're coming out before we make a final decision about it. But, you know, at the moment, we have the opportunity of using chemotherapy and an IO in those patients with advanced disease, which is a step forward in itself.
All right, so back to PARPs. Dr. Powell, I'm going to start with you. Do you think there's strong biologic rationale for PARP inhibitor inclusion in the treatment of endometrial cancer? And was I able to convince you that there was some synergy between that and checkpoint inhibitors?
Well, we were hopeful that that was the case. It's less than overwhelming when we look at the data. I think it may contribute to a little bit of PFS, but I agree with what Dr. Lederman just said. The OS, I think, is key in what we found in ovarian cancer, too. How do we look at OS when people live a long time and get multiple different agents? In this setting, though, I think the OS is concerning. I mean, for RUBY Part 2, we didn't see improvements there, not enough trend to where I would say, oh, we need to add a PARP to this regimen that's already working. As I mentioned, in DOE, that's not mature. I mean, we use 28% maturity. Hopefully, we'll have an update and see. It may help the PD-L1 work a little better. But again, finding that right patient to add that additional toxicity and balance those risk benefits, I don't know who that patient is yet. So I have not added PARPs into endometrial cancer at this point.
And I didn't share the overall survival data with you, but I think maybe there is some harm that we're doing. So I think we need to be...
There's a potential for harm. So I think, be cautious there.
Yeah. Dr. Backus, anything to add in regards to, the role of PARP inhibitors? What if you had a patient with a BRCA2 mutation?
I think those are definitely the group that you would consider, but that's a very, those were barely any in the trials. In the RUBY 2, they couldn't do the forest plots because there weren't enough patients with HRR mutations or with BRCA2, so we see it works. But looking at your data, Dr. Powell, like what you were just showing in a DMMR, in RUBY, in the part two, like now your hazard ratio goes from 0.3 to 0.6. Like that's puzzling me a little bit. I wrote it down here. I was like, well, what is going on?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Do you want to let us know what's going on?
Sorry, putting you on the spot.
Well, like I said, I'm cautious. I don't think it added anything. Certainly adding niraparib did not seem to help dostarlimab, and definitely not enough to where we'd say there's a signal worth investigating further.
We got some questions from the audience that one is a little near and dear to my heart. So patient with no radiologic evidence of disease on immunotherapy, let's say maintenance therapy, are you getting surveillance scans in asymptomatic patients? And if so, how often? Dr. Backus, I'm going to start with you.
We should ask this to you.
No,
I think this question came out to you.
She was one of my fellows, and she actually helped me write the very first surveillance paper. So.
And then she kicked me off, but that's okay. Different thing. But do you do surveillance scans? I don't routinely, if they're not, if they're feeling fine, I do them again at the point where I'm thinking about taking them off. And after I've taken them off, that will be the moment that I do scan them again to see if now that they're off, do they develop a rapid recurrence. But while they're on, if they're not on trial and it's not mandated, no, not routinely.
Dr. Powell, any other thoughts?
Yeah, again, I would agree completely with what you said, not routinely, but you know, we don't have a great way to survey these patients, and the patients are often really wondering why I'm not getting scans, and dealing with insurance companies is something none of us like doing.
So, see, there is an indication for ctDNA in patients getting immunotherapy. Have either of you employed that as a tool for surveillance?
Not routinely. I mean, we have some cases where we're doing that in, but yeah, not routinely.
Yeah. And I mean, I agree. I think that, you know, it's definitely a patient-physician discussion every single time, because there are some patients who are very adamant about it. But unless it's going to change your decision, it may not be important, and especially in these asymptomatic patients. You may be, you know, messing with something that's actually, you know, providing them some benefit. But that's, you know, this is all based on retrospective data thus far. So, you know, we talked a little bit about recurrence and rechallenging of patients. What is your typical strategy? So you have a patient with immunotherapy who received immunotherapy up front with chemotherapy. What next? Patient recurs, has a pretty symptomatic recurrence. When do you choose? Clinical patients just not interested in clinical trials. Let's just take that off the table. How do you decide what the next line of therapy is? Let's say it's a short interval or she progressed on immunotherapy. What is your go-to second line?
Yeah, so this is going to be, assuming this is a high-grade patient, I take it the hormonal therapy is not, otherwise for a low-grade, yes, hormonal therapy, as we were talking about. But I think we're still very limited in our options here. You hope that she's HER2 highly expressor, that she's HER2 3+, but I assume she's not that either. So then we're still back to doxorubicin or weekly paclitaxel, and we don't really still don't have any other approved agents available. So we've made a ton of progress, but we need more options. So so for me, that goes to one of those two still.
Yeah. I think also rechallenging with platinum agent reg doublet is also a reasonable strategy, depending on what their interval was. Dr. Pell?
No, I would agree that, you know, I would, again, consider reprofiling if, you know, depending on how old those prior biopsies or where they were obtained before to look for signals. And also talk her into a clinical trial, perhaps.
You are a sweet talker, so if anybody could do it. I want to get back to bevacizumab really briefly. So we've talked about it. I've used it in patients, and I'm curious to see what your experience is. Have you guys used it? Do you use it strategically? Is it kind of in that recurrent setting? Dr. Backus, I'm going to start with you.
Yes, in the chemotherapy with bevacizumab, yes. Do we see some benefit probably with weekly paclitaxel and adding it? Bevacizumab, like we do in ovarian cancer patients, yes. Do we use it in others by itself as a treatment? No, I think we don't really see a lot of response there.
Dr. Powell, have you used bevacizumab in what setting?
Typically, again, in the NCCN guidelines, we do have the platinum taxane bevacizumab arm that's within that, and that is a kind of a nice second-line or third-line regimen if they, you know, I could still have this sense of some kind of platinum window, although I don't have evidence behind that, but to think it's still quite active regimen.
Yeah, it's interesting. If the trial pans out and we started using Bev and Pembro in the front line with chemotherapy, then lenvatinib and pembrolizumab probably really wouldn't play a role because you're rechallenging with similar strategies. So it'll be interesting to see how things pan out. What are you most excited about moving forward, Dr. Powell?
I do think, I think most clinical trials operations have several ADCs in development in this space. And I think as we look at TOP1 or and folate receptor, other things out there. I mean, there's a host of things that are coming. It's going to get more complicated, but we've seen some amazing responses in the ADC world.
Yeah, Dr. Backus.
Wish they'd last a little longer.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah, and then totally with that too. The one thing, I think that this is the other thing that we need to start thinking about as well. Like if we're starting to give all these maintenance drugs, Pembro, Bevacizumab, a maintenance ADC that we're putting in advanced endometrial cancer with or without immunotherapy, how long do we really need to continue treating? So my excitement would be for like that we can figure out like a limitation that we're not having to commit these patients. I mean, it's one thing to be on a hormonal therapy for indefinite. Most patients do just fine with that, if it's a single agent or. But for these ADCs and immunotherapy, it gets a little harder.
Well, this wraps up our program. I want to again thank our amazing faculty, both online and in person. Thank you so much for being here today.